due to what Russ has said about your attendance tonight. I'm in some ways intimidated by all the elderly experience that is here already. I'm looking forward to tomorrow where we'll get to share that with each other. The session is tomorrow, somewhat interactive, and we'll be looking at specific cases and questions that I don't know the answer to, so maybe we'll solve some of those problems. But we'll talk a little bit more about the model of the church as elders are to oversee it. And Russ kind of spilled the beans at the end. We really only have one simple message for this weekend. In a way, it's the theme of all the sessions, and that is elders shepherd sheep. It's an individual shepherding. And I think that emphasis in some ways has been lost in some groups. Sometimes when things go very smoothly, it's easy to lose that. Despite that, however, I'm going to talk about elders as shepherds of a collective group. And I'm going to talk about that for a little while because there is a role there, and I'll prove that to you with a couple of verses. But you'll see how these fit together at the end when we get through with that. The reference to the flock as a collective group is found several places related to elders. Take heed to yourselves and to the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Flock is a singular noun, right? But it's one of those collective nouns. It means there's some things within it. The same thing in this passage here. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, and so on. So this idea of the flock as a collective unit is quite scriptural in what it does. So I would ask you, this is my outline, I'll go on. I want to talk about some misconceptions about this collective unit. Think about this. And I think when we have attended a church a long time, or in a community where the church has been around for a long time, maybe we've grown up in the church and haven't really seen a contrast with other places, we have a temptation to see the church in maybe some erroneous ways. I don't mean we say this out loud, but just in the way we think about things, and even in the way we think about leaders and how they ought to be selected. When I was preparing this material, I was in Georgia, and we have a thing called an inspection station for our vehicles. And I'm seeing blank looks. Y'all know what that is? Well, I understand that, that there's not such a thing in Alabama. But anyway, I guess that means all the pollution just comes right on over into Georgia, and then we have to get our vehicles inspected to help with that. You know what I mean by an inspection station, though, right? It would be like you have to get your driver's license renewed. Y'all do have driver's license here. Okay? So it's something that you kind of have to do it. It is your favorite thing to do. Is it so much fun that you think, I'm going to go every 6 months instead of waiting for a year to get it done? What's important about getting your driver's license renewed or your vehicle inspected is how convenient it is and how quickly it's done. I have to do it, but let's don't make an ordeal out of it. And I'll tell you this, when I've had my vehicle inspected or my driver's license renewed, it does not change my life, even for the rest of the day, does it? I've just come in and I've done my duty and I move ahead. And if you were choosing leaders for an institution or organization like that, what might be some of the premium qualities of a leader like that? Yeah, nothing goes undone. We get it done, and not only attention to the detail, but what else? Efficiency. Let's make it run. You know, don't pave the parking lot. You know what I mean? So it's convenient. It's smooth. It's pleasant. I get it done as well, as pleasant as it can be, given, you know, the kind of thing. I think a little better model, perhaps, would be a club of people who have a common interest. Maybe it's a book club. Maybe it's a club about music and so on. In that case, it's somewhat voluntary. You don't have to go. You go because you like it. There's something about that that's very pleasant. And you go and you talk about things that are of interest to you. You maybe have this feeling of being improved. You certainly are entertained. It's an enjoyable experience. And what would a leader of a group like that excel at, you think? What would make a good leader of something that's a common interest club? Oh, he's fired up. In fact, he's not only fired up himself, but what else? We're all fired up, right? And that keeps people coming. And what's the experience when you're there? Oh, it's happy. In fact, if you come and everybody in this common interest club is fighting all the time, they'll lose interest. It's not worth coming. I came for a specific pleasurable thing to happen, and that's not happening. And this leader's not getting the job done, and so I'm just going to go somewhere else. use my time differently. Another model is that the church, a local church, is like a corporation or a business. And that is that there's some premium on things like growth, right? There's progress. There's a goal. This corporation has been established in order to accomplish something, right? Something like that. And what kind of a leader would you want there? Yeah, so he's results-oriented. In fact, the thing, neat thing about a business or a corporation, there are some pretty numerical quantifications of success, aren't there? What's the profits? What's the growth? What's the revenue? What's the top line? You know, what's the overhead rates that we're achieving and that kind of thing? Let me ask you another question about a business or a corporation. What happens if you hire someone and they're not productive? Well, yeah, right? I mean, you've heard of somebody, you hire them and you have to hire two more people to make up for that, right? What would a good leader do in that situation? Got an unproductive employee, maybe even worse, they're harmful. They don't just not do anything, they mess things up, right? They create more scrap than they do value, right? Something like that. What would a good leader in a corporate group like that do? He would take action, and he'd be decisive, and he would understand that there are bigger goals than this little employee's good, you know, welfare, right? We've got to move on and accomplish other things. I would say about all three of these models, and you can think about how, well, there's a little bit like the church, local church there. You can see some similarities, but at the same time, there's another goal behind these, right, that's kind of independent of the people that make it up. Do you see that? Keep that thought in your head. The easiest one to illustrate is the corporation. In some sense, if I could eliminate all my labor costs and still make a profit as a good business guy, what would I do? I'd fire everybody and just rake the money in. Wouldn't you do that? In fact, that's kind of like selling software, right? Just collect the license fee. You see what I mean? There's a goal, an operational goal, which is somewhat independent of each individual member. Even the club probably has this sense of self-perpetuation. And if someone's a troublemaker in the club or is always fighting or arguing, what would we rather them do? Just not come to the meeting. You know what? This isn't for you. Just move on. Keep those thoughts in mind as we kind of think about what the church actually is. So, save time. I've covered all this. I would like to sneak up on this idea of what a better model of the church is by looking at what a church does. Now, I mean a local church, and I mean a collective group. Remember, we're talking about flock shepherding, this collective group. What do churches do? What do Christians collectively do when they're assembled together? Can you think of anything that the Bible says they should do? They worship. Can you tell me some specifics about that? I'll give a hint. Right? Yeah, there's five things I can think of. And they are pray, sing, observe the Lord's Supper, listen, if you combine teaching and preaching, I guess, then that would make five and not six. So they all fit on one hand. And that's what assembled Christians did. Can you think of anything else that we have examples in the New Testament that assembled Christians did? And I'm kind of presuming, but I think it's obvious, that if you're assembled in the same space at the same time, you're doing something collectively, right? I mean, there was a condemnation in 1 Corinthians 11 about not doing that, right? Not being together when they were supposed to be. What are some things that Bible examples of the congregation doing things collectively? There's what? Yes, that's right. 1 Corinthians 5, you remember that? Paul even emphasizes when the whole church is gathered together. This is something they did at a special time. Everyone, what else? That's good. Another. Sure, these are ways in which that is done, but there's kind of this general discussion, Hebrews 10, about, you know, exhorting one another and provoking to love and good works. The specifics of the activity are not exactly given, but that's what it's for. That's what they did. Good, good. Others? Okay, you remember when Paul and Barnabas, first journey, they returned to Antioch after having been selected. The whole church... Check this out. I think it's Acts chapter, 14, is it? What's that? Yeah, 14. The whole church gathered together to hear a report from a man who had been preaching the gospel. And a great door of opportunity had been opened to the Gentiles. Great news. They all gathered together to hear about that. Kind of important in light of the controversy about to come in chapter 15, right? But how did Paul and Barnabas get sent out at the beginning, chapter 13? They're all together. They prayed and they fasted and they picked those men. Holy Spirit helped them, sent them on their way. So picking men to go preach, hearing their reports when they get back. These are things Christians did assemble. What else? Are there other things? Good. Acts chapter 6, they had a problem. You can almost list two things there. One is they came together to say, we have a problem. And the other is the apostle said, here's what we're going to do. And you need to go pick some men and we will go and appoint them over this matter. While we're on that point, I'll just ask this question. Is there any sense that the church had a collective mood, attitude, feeling at any time? Can you think of any cases like that? We're actually talking about one right this minute. That's why I brought it up. What was the response of the church in Acts chapter 6 when the apostles said, here's what we're going to do to solve this problem of the Grecian widows? What was their response? It pleased the whole multitude. I just wonder how you know that. I don't know that every single person was pleased, but the sense was that the whole group had, as a group, had a feeling about that. You know what I mean? And there are other places, just like the Acts chapter 15, well, as another example, where there was actually a false teaching. They gathered together, they discussed the matter, they decided this must be God's will based on the Old Testament and experience of Paul, and they said, you know what we should do? We should write a letter, and the saying what? Please the whole multitude. There we are again. There's a group response to what's going on. So I think these are some ideas. Okay, good examples. I will mention a couple. In James 2, the suggestion is that people come into your assembly and how you collectively treat them is real important. If a poor man comes in shabby clothing and you don't welcome him, and a rich man comes in fine apparel and you welcome him, you're making a big mistake. You're being a respecter of persons, in some ways guilty of the whole. Remember that? So the collective work really is to welcome visitors. Similarly, in 1 Corinthians 14, where they were exercising spiritual gifts and apparently doing it in such a confusing and shameful way, even with women in a dominant position, what were they saying to visitors? And the passage is, God is not the God of. What were they saying by that behavior? God is the God of confusion, right? But what it says, if you conduct yourself in a way that people see that, you collectively are saying that God is among you and He'll fall down and worship God. That's what that passage says, 1 Corinthians 14. Is it possible that our worship itself is a way in which we are actually collectively teaching people? I think that's what that's saying exactly. So those are collective actions. Select and appoint workers, we mentioned that. Workers to go elsewhere, hear reports from workers, publicly condemn an unrepentant brother, and then we mentioned initiate an unexplained discipline, 1 Corinthians 5, with the whole church gathered. And one last one, which we can't leave out, since this is a weekend on elders, is reprove elders that sin. Go read that verse in 1 Timothy 5. Who's supposed to be there? Reprove in the sight of all. So it's a collective activity. Elders that sin. Some teaching being done by that action. So these are collective things. Now, in the New Testament, they're similar. This is a list of some of the things are the same. These are not the things that they necessarily did when assembled together, but as a collective group, they needed to decide on these things or resolve the issues. And I'll just go through some of them. They had to deal with complaints of neglect. They had to select men for the office and duties. Russ mentioned that they had to decide whether to allow a man to join the church. This is the case of Saul. There were disputes among members. Can I take a parenthesis here on that one? 1 Corinthians 6, as you know, is a condemnation of those Corinthians, because what were they doing? What was the terrible thing they were doing? They were suing one another. And Paul says, if you go to law before unbelievers, it's an utter failure, I think is the New King James Version. You have just messed up really bad. But the solution, good news, is what? Well, yeah, he actually calls it, he says, is there none wise among you? There must be some wise people. I wonder who might be wise people in a church with elders. Who might you go to resolve an issue? And it might be what we call a carnal issue, right? A money issue, a debt, a disagreement, right? Something. That seems to be the kinds of issues it was. He says, bring that to the Christians. the wise Christians, we would hope an elder would fall in that category. So that's something that the church, in fact, Euodian, Syntychian, Philippians 4, how are they supposed to resolve that? Help these women. I think he's addressing the church. Everyone, get involved with that. Help them sort this out. Sorry, I'm back on the parenthesis for a second. Think about a disagreement. How about a disagreement, we talked about maybe between two brethren, one owes money and that kind of thing. How about a disagreement between a husband and a wife? One has a charge against the other. A suspicion, perhaps. Or maybe it's a charge, the other one denies it, and there you are, you're stuck. How might that be resolved? Do you think that passage in 1 Corinthians 6 covers that situation? As a better alternative than, say, going to law? Hiring lawyers, which, by the way, in our experience, they love to be hired. They love to extend the controversy. These are because they're unbelievers, really. Don't you think that's in the heart of the passage? Okay, close parenthesis, I'm off the topic on that. We'll get back to that more on Sunday morning. Hosting and recruiting preachers, interesting verses. Paul says, I'm sending Timothy. Like it or not, you welcome him and treat him well. And he also says, and I talked to Apollos about coming. Sorry, can't. So it seems like they wanted Apollos, maybe they didn't care for Timothy, I don't know. But in any case, Paul is saying, as a church, you're going to host, and they also were interested. They debated the doctrinal issue in Acts 15. They sent a letter to another church. They selected and appointed men to preach. They committed to send money to needy, and Paul had to remind them about a commitment. They committed to it. And they selected men to carry those gifts once they were done. 1 Corinthians 16, whoever you pick to carry. That was a church, that was a congregational kind of decision that reflected their collective will. So what do elders do? And I just want to mention this point again a little bit in passing, and that is that in the book of Acts, you see an evolution from the early Acts 2, Acts 4, Acts 5. Acts 5, they're actually arrested. The apostles are in the lead there. In Acts chapter 6, with the appointed deacons, the apostles. Finally, in chapter 11, there's a famine in Judea. And when the collection is made and sent, who is it laid at the feet of? The elders. It's interesting that Luke has not explained what an elder is when he gets to that passage. I don't fully know the answer for that. But you know, it's a little bit like in John chapter 6 when Jesus turns to the 12. And if you read John, he hasn't explained who the 12 are. He just assumes you've read the other accounts, I think. That's how you're supposed to know. What are elders, you might say? A little more parenthesis. I think everyone knows what elders were because elders have been typical of God's people from the very beginning. You can go back to Moses. Who did he go talk to of the Israelites when he went back to Egypt? Right? There were elders appointed at the advice of the son and the father-in-law, Jethro, right? Remember that? Older men have always led God's people. That's kind of always been the case. And groups of elders show up all through the history of Israel. So it's not like we don't know what they are or don't understand that. But Acts 11, they appear to distribute the needy goods. And in Acts 15, it's elders and apostles addressing this issue over circumcision for the Gentiles. And finally, when you get to chapter 21, when Paul shows up with a bad reputation, you know, for Gentiles, they kind of meet him at the door and say, hey, we got to, but who is it? It's James and the elders. The apostles aren't even mentioned. Interesting. The persecution, the apostles stay. Anyway, there's an evolution, it seems, from apostles and elders to elders. And I think it is fair to look at the apostles as prototypical, really, of the elders' functions. And we'll do a little bit of that in the early part of the church, just like those men who deaconed served tables in chapter 6 are somewhat prototypical of deacons. I think that's a fair way to read it. So here are some things that elders did. They distributed gifts. They met to consider doctrinal questions. They chose men to send. They wrote a letter to another church. They met to discuss their work. And with Paul, Acts 20, we'll come back to that. They made plans to avoid problems. And they gave gifts or appointed men to specific tasks. Timothy is the example there. Notice that almost all of those are matters of judgment. They are not really, you might say in Acts 15 they were addressing doctrinal questions, determining truth, but really how they went about that and how they went about disseminating that by means of a letter, that was a matter of judgment. I don't even think it was revealed by God. It was just a decision. We have to make this somehow. Should we send out preachers? Should we just write a letter and send that out? So, They're exercising matters of judgment. And then James 5 talks about praying for anointing the sick. What are the advantages of having men who are there to help make these collective judgmental decisions? What's the advantage of that? You want to take too much liberty knowing the mind of God, but why do you think that is a better plan, perhaps? Yeah. Right. Right. You would think. And so the whole idea of elders is having collected that over time. If you have to narrow the decision down to somebody making it, let's pick the ones who are most likely to maybe have the most experience that lead to that. These are just pragmatic things. So making it an orderly thing. I've noticed this when we have a more of an open session. We wouldn't necessarily do this in the assembly, but anybody's allowed to speak. I'm not going to try to embarrass anybody that's already spoken up. But the people who will speak up are the ones who kind of already have the most forward personalities, right? There's some people who never speak up. They may be the wisest ones. And sometimes you get an inversion of experience in those kind of public settings where the person who talks the most has the least knowledge or expertise about it. They just have a dominant personality. And so it's an orderly way to make decisions. I think there's something else, too, and that is if we just wait till a decision's about to become a crisis, that's not a good plan either, is it? So I think the whole idea that we have some initiative, some looking ahead to say, hey, you know what, this is going to become a crisis if we don't address it. The building will fall down if we don't do something about it, right? Or there's a level of dissatisfaction with the Grecian widows. It could probably go on for months, but we need to take initiative and address it. So this idea of bringing a decision to closure and to attention. And finally, setting directions. And by that I mean that there's a priority in things. And I wouldn't kind of glom in on this passage. Both of these passages imply that. I'll mention briefly, 1 Timothy 5:16 has to do with supporting younger widows. Actually, with not supporting younger widows, right? That are not widows indeed. Why is that? He says that the church be not... Do you mean it's a burden on the church to support these widows? It almost implies that might not be the real priority of the church. Its real work shouldn't be a burden. That's its goal. That's its mission. But similarly, really, look at Acts chapter 6, verses 2 and verse 4. What is the reason these men are needed to serve tables? So the apostles could do what? Give their attention to prayer and the word. Verse 4 has both of those, right? Prayer, I think, is in, only one of them is in verse 2. I think it's prayer. Do you mean to say that it's more important to have the apostles praying and teaching than it is to have them feeding people? Yeah, that's what it seems to be saying, isn't it? And the same thing, is the primary mission of the church to keep widows fed, or is it to do something along a different line? Sure, sometimes there are people who are needy, but it's a burden. It's not the core mission of the church. I think, so with a kind of, that just seems to me that there's things that are not wrong or right, but they're more important, some are. Even though that we may have a responsibility scripturally appropriate to do, but it seems to me that people who have the initiative to solve it and have an idea of what's important would address that as well. Okay, I just left us with these terrible pictures of the church as an inspection station and a club of common interest and a business or corporation. We understand how there's something wrong with each of those pictures. Well, what is the church? And so let's try to address that with a couple of passages and from that reason about what elders really would do. Here's a passage in Ephesians 4. For time, I won't read it. It's a passage that I find at Embry Hills. We come back to over and over because it's a little bit of a charter statement for what the church is about. What's it for? But notice it begins with gifts. In fact, if you back up in the text a little bit, there's a prophecy quoted about giving gifts to men. Interesting, the context is warlike if you go back to the psalm that's from. But giving gifts to men. And the gifts that he gives are apostles, prophets, evangelists, and pastors and teachers. So there's a start. These gifts are in place for something. And you can see from the text it has to do with the body. That is the church. And it's the health of the body and so on. Let's see if we can diagram that a little bit. So here are these gifts, which include pastors, verse 11. Remember what Russ said about it. Those are shepherds. That's the word. That's elders are part of that group, along with apostles and prophets, as well as teachers. And so what they're supposed to do is for the equipping of the saints. That doesn't tell me very much. They're handing out toolkits. But what for? What are those tools to be used for? Well, to do the work of the ministry. Okay, that's okay, but what's the work? You see, we're not getting quite that information. And what he says it's for is to edify or build up the body. There's a sense of constructing the body and making it stronger and helping it grow. That's what's there. And he talks about that till we all come to the unity of the faith. That sounds like a collective goal. Wouldn't it be nice if everyone in this collective group had unified beliefs and unified convictions and so on? Paul says to the Corinthians, be of one mind and one judgment. Remember that in 1 Corinthians 1. He says, we all come to unity of the faith, a knowledge and a perfect man, verse 13. Full grown, I think, is the idea there. Strong, healthy people, vibrant. So that we're not tossed about. And he says, so that you'll no longer be children tossed about. What does that suggest, that there might be children in the church? And I don't mean young people, do I, here? What do I mean by when I say there might be children? No longer children. What does it mean? Right. We want everyone who's immature to become. Does that mean we don't want any immature people to start with? No, that's what we're doing. We're taking them from being immature to being mature, right? But he said, I want everybody to be no longer this, but become this. And that's part of the work of strengthening. So that's protective. So they're not swept away, easily deceived by every wind of doctrine and that kind of thing. But also it's progressive in the sense that they're growing up. They're becoming adults. That doesn't mean we don't want children. It's that we want children to stay children. We want them to grow and become stronger. That's what the church does. And if you look at that kind of core there in the middle, those are individual goals. Each person wants to be growing up so they're not tossed, and they want to be able to be defended or defend themselves against the false teaching. And he says one more thing about the edifying of the body, that you're knit together. I believe that's collective. There's a tie that binds everyone. Knit together by your participation, that which every joint supplies, and the building and the growth and the building up of the body in love. Those are the glue pieces that bring that group together. And so what you see then is this cocoon, this culture dish, this controlled environment in which that perfection of each member then can happen. And do you see how this puts the collective leadership of the elder in a different context than just things running smoothly or growing to be twice the size that we are today and 10 years from now? You see the difference is we're making an environment, according to this passage, that allows each person to become perfect, to stop being a child and grow into something else. And it seems to me that would help inform an elder about the priorities that they would set, wouldn't it? What is the most important thing to pay attention to? And you can see that in the priorities of the apostles in Acts chapter 6, the same thing. So when you see an elder's work, yes, there are collective decisions that keep everybody unified, that keep the body from being fractious, that get decisions made in an efficient way, but they're aimed at this perfect man, the individual development of each Christian. That ought to be the priority, the thing that informs their decision. So, I'm going to turn to Acts chapter 20 and take a look at that, and I will assert to you that this is a pattern. Russ said, where are the passages thought about elders? The more we think about it, Acts 20 may be the best place to go for a kind of extended discussion. Because Paul says there that he is their example. Look at these passages. By the way, this is an elders meeting, isn't it? Right? The elders from what church? You know, Ephesus. But they didn't meet in Ephesus. They met in, do you may know where? Miletus was an offsite, right? And Paul came in as a consultant. But anyway, okay. But they had an elders meeting. And he says in verse 18, you know from what the first day that I came to Asia in what manner I always lived among you. Why is he bringing himself up there and saying, you know how I live? Because he's the pattern. He wants them to think about what he did among them. Look at verse 31. Therefore watch and remember that for 3 years, remember that's how long he was there, I did not cease to warn everyone night and day with tears. Verse 35, I have shown you in every way by laboring like this. Paul's saying to these elders, by the way, he warns them, take heed yourselves into the flock. That's what he's saying. But he's saying, guess who you might think about as an example of what an elder's job would be? He says, remember how I did that. I left you this example, particularly in verse 35. So they're an example. What are the goals of the work? Well, first, he says, I want you to know, because I labored like this, I'm innocent of the blood of every person. And that's because he declared the whole counsel of God. He labored night and day with tears. He labored publicly and from house to house. I don't want to make too big of a deal with that. Does that sound a little bit like flock and sheep shepherding? He labored publicly and maybe they all fit in the house, but anyway, from house to house suggests individual. Now, maybe that was just evangelism, but it seems like there's a public and a private work that he did. So that's what he did. And he says, not only that, there's bad things coming. You need to be having that same protective attitude. And he also, not just surviving, but here, just like in Ephesians, it's protective, but also it's progressive. This word is able to build you up. And in verse 35, I just want to spend a minute thinking about that, because I think we're coming close to a better model of the church. Verse 35. I've shown you in every way, by laboring like this, you must support the faithful Christians, the rich Christians that contribute a lot of money. Right? No, the weak. And who are the weak? Are they the people that have problems? Yeah. Are they the people that sometimes are counterproductive to what the church is trying to do? Yeah. Are they the people that are always in the bench every service? No. He's saying, I labor like this to tell you who to support. And here's an idea of a better model of the church, although it's imperfect in a lot of ways. We've talked about this in Ember Hills quite a bit. Think of a hospital. Why do you go to a hospital? You're sick and you want to get well. That's what hospitals do. Imagine a sick person showing up at the door and says, I'm hurting. And they say, sorry. You'll distract us. Right? You'll be a drain on our resources if you come in here. Right? Because you're sick. No, hospitals are for helping people that are sick to get better. Or imagine this situation. Someone comes in and they don't say anything. Why are you here? No, I just wanted to visit. I'm just visiting. That's it? Well, it turns out that every time they eat, they throw up and they have terrible pains in their gut. But they don't ever mention that while they're in the hospital. You see the analogy I'm making here? Are they going to get much benefit out of that hospital? Now, you see, the real plan is for people to come to the hospital and say, I'm sick, and here are my symptoms, and for the people in the hospital to do what? Help them. Help them grow. Help the weak, Paul says. I showed you this in every way, that our goal is to help the weak. That's what the church is for. Sometimes people get confused when they come on Sundays and everybody's wearing their best suits, or they're dressed up, and the kids are moderately well-behaved on Sunday mornings, right? And so it's pretty clear there are no marriages that are struggling at all and no kids that are struggling at all with things in their lives, right? Because if you just look around, you can tell everybody's well here. There are no problems. You know what I mean? No, we're sick. We're all of us sick. Now, here's a difference with a hospital. You hope the doctors and nurses are not sick. But in the church, is that the case? No. I'm afraid the strong people are still trying to grow and get well, and get over the things in their lives that are a problem. You see that? Even elders. You might ask the question, who elders the elders, right? In fact, Paul discusses in this passage how I supported myself and others. He mentions about laboring with his own hands. There's a sense in which elders do double duty in the sense they've got to figure out how to keep themselves well and help other people do well. Paul says, I'm setting this example for you. You understand what I mean? Who elders the elder? Well, maybe it's the other elders, and that's certainly a blessing. But I'm saying there's this double burden for those who have achieved the spiritual strength that they can manage their own health. Take heed to what? Yourselves and to the flock. There's this double duty there, and that is doctors. Now, all the other thing about hospitals is nowadays, as soon as you get kind of halfway well, what do? You're out. Yeah, but that's not the idea. What we want people to do is to get well enough that they begin to make other people better, to help them as well. That's kind of a better picture of that. So think about that as an image. And I can almost say it's scriptural because Paul said, I've shown you this, that you should be helping the weak. And I think that's the picture that's there. And he says the reason is there's a destiny out there. Here are some things that Paul did, which I think reflect the elder's job based on Acts 20. He proclaimed everything publicly from house to house. He declared the whole counsel of God. He took heed to himself and to the flock itself. He was protective from external threats. They needed to be protected from internal threats. He watched and warned night and day. He provided for his own needs and for the needs of others. I think that's a challenging but accurate model of what shepherds have to do in a collective sense. There's double duty. They're providing for themselves and for the needs of others. And here are the things that they do in that group. And of course, the bottom line is supporting the weak. Now, we won't talk about these, but tomorrow with the men, there's kind of a job description. We have four pages, I guess. Here's a couple of them. These are duties that you might think about as an elder that you need to be prepared for, that handle collective matters. We have another two pages related to individual shepherding matters, but here they are. Provide spiritual food, exhortation, motivation, lead discipline, provide for edifying worship, correct doctrinal errors. Are these physical things, or are they related primarily to the health of the soul of the individuals, really? Even though they're collective decisions, they really have a goal of helping those individual souls. So how does the flock support this? Well, first, please shed the worldly views of what the church is. And I'll tell you where they show up. They show up kind of in disgruntlement. You know, these classes are not very good. The building is so hot. Can we not get the air conditioning to work right? The traffic, parking is terrible. Do we sometimes, I think maybe sometimes if we're not very involved in the work, which we all should be doing, what we see in the elders is when they stand up at the table, like Wayne did a few minutes ago, and make some announcement, right? And that's kind of the extent of what we see them doing. We think, well, they're just managing the affairs, the finances, the preacher selection, those kind of things. No, you see a different vision of what an elder is. It's way more important. So let's think about that. And when we see that, suddenly these external issues, these matters of just, is the inspection station running smoothly? Could we have a drive-up Lord's Supper window? Have we thought about, you know, something that would be very, you know, those issues do not, they just don't come up. We have such a much more significant issue, which is helping people grow who are weak and who are sick to become what they need to be so that they'll have an eternal destiny. That's the role that we have. And so related to that, suppress criticism and strife. Timothy is told by Paul that against an elder, receive not an accusation in the mouth of two or three witnesses. I think sometimes we are thinking, well, if it's a big deal, don't go charge the elder with a serious sin unless you've got a lot of evidence behind it. I think it's more than that. And it's in the context of judging men's characters, if you read that chapter carefully. I think he's saying, hey, be really careful, because that criticism undermines those men's capability to do the work that they do. I think there's a special protection. Now, there's a special punishment if they sin. It seems like in that same passage, reprove in the sight of all. But I think elders should be given a special, tolerance, if you will, if it's that negative, a special respect, a special protection for murmuring. Essentially, the children of Israel were punished more instantly for murmuring and challenging Moses' leadership than they were for idolatry and the golden calf. Compare Korah and you see what I mean? This murmuring, read 1 Corinthians 10 about that as a serious sin against God. Esteem them highly. And I'll bring up this passage because I just want to say a little bit about that. It says, brethren, recognize those. This is 1 Thessalonians. Amazing to me that only a few months after that church was started, they had elders. But he says, we urge you to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you. Pretty good description of elders in their sheep shepherding role. And esteem them very highly in love, because they're the smartest people in the church. Because they never make mistakes. Because they were elected by a majority of the group. Because they've outlived most of them. What is it about the elders that deserves this esteem them highly? For what? It's what they're trying to do. There's nothing inherently magic or superior. They have an important work to do, which we saw in Acts 20. Which is helping the weak, helping us all to become stronger, to grow up to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That's their work. And who gave them that work? Over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseer. That work came from the Holy Spirit. Pretty important work. And for that reason, they're to be respected highly. Not because they know more Bible than anyone else, they never make a mistake, or they're most friendly people, or they got elected by most of the church. That's not the point. Y'all see where I'm headed with this. This is their work, and their work is about souls. They watch in behalf of your souls. That's what we learn from this passage. And finally, then, of course, that leads to submission. And I won't say too much about this until Sunday morning, but I do want to say more about that then. Here's an interesting passage in 1 Corinthians 16. I never saw this for the longest time. It's in the middle of a bunch of greetings. You think, okay, what? Skip over that. He says here, I urge you, brothers, that you know the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Asia, and they that have devoted themselves to the service of the saints, verse 16, be subject to them. Are they elders? The household of Stephanas, are they elders here? It doesn't even appear that they're really necessarily in that church. And yet, what is he calling on us to do, or the Corinthians to do here? Be subject to them. Would it be the case that when anyone is in the service of the saints, that's probably something we all kind of sign up to and be subject to them in the way that they're working and the way they're... And this is not something you have to do. It. You have to submit because God says you have to. This is something you want to do because of the value that they have and so on. And then this one we've already looked at. We'll say some more about that on that. Sunday as well. All right, I'm done. I didn't do as well as you make all the time, did I?
Okay, I know you've been sitting for a while. For those of us in business, sitting in a two-hour meeting is not necessarily unusual. So, or go to a conference and sit for an hour and a half. So, it's a little unusual for us, but maybe we'll be all right. What we're going to do now is just break out in some groups. It'll give you time to kind of stand up, walk around a little bit. Ladies, if you'll go across the hall, if you stay with us, across the hall to the ladies' classroom, Shirley and Barbara and Sandy, either who are elders' wives, or Sandy has been in the past, are going to talk to you a little bit about the role and what's involved and what it's like to be an elder's wife. Sixth grade through high school, if you'll go to the college classroom, Marty's going to come talk to you and just ask you some questions that you might find challenging to think about a little bit along that line. And then the men who are left, if you'll kind of assemble the center section toward the back, like the high school, the auditorium class does in here, center section toward the back, Russ is going to be in here with us, and we'll do that. It won't last too much longer, but just a little while, and we'll get you out of here. But appreciate very much you being here. Men, back tomorrow at 9 o'clock or 1 o'clock. Dual sessions, same thing, morning, same thing, afternoon. We got a lot more coming in the morning than do the afternoon, so if anybody wants to shift, that's fine too. But, see you then, appreciate you coming. You're-